So here we are. I also want to let you know that my co-host here, Stu Robbins, is also on the phone.
How you doing, Will?
Good. Hi, Stu.
And we want to thank you for giving us a little bit of your time today.
Yeah. Hey, what time is it in New York? It's only 10:30 here.
Yeah, well, it's 4:30 in the afternoon here. It's the end of a work day.
It's past my bedtime here already.
Yeah, me too, man.
Wait a minute. It's only 10:30 over there, man.
Yeah, but I've been over there a lot. I've been playing a lot of music. We just finished 2 dates with Seven Walkers in San Francisco, and then before then I just came from Gathering the Vibes.
How was that? How have the gigs been?
That was great. That particular gig went really well, I thought, and heard back. I heard people on YouTube and stuff. You know, people recorded it. We had fire dancers there. It always makes it exciting. It went good. The gigs have been going really good. Everything's been going good.
Some visual stuff to go along with it, huh?
Yeah, I always thought, you know, fire and dancing goes real good with drums.
You know, we haven't really officially introduced you yet. The show is Morning Dew, and you're on WBAI-FM in New York at 99.5 on your dial. And we're also WBAI.org, so you can hear us live over your computer, actually anywhere in the world.
Right. We're here in Hawaii.
Hawaii, and we have the great honor and privilege of having Mr. Billy Kreutzmann on the air with us, one of the Rhythm Devils, one of the prime movers behind drumming as it has evolved in the last 40 or so years.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And my name's Don Grossinger, and we have Stu Robbins here as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, you guys want to fire away. I'm all ready to go answer some questions.
All right. I got a question for you about the extravaganza at Giant Stadium out there in San Francisco. So I got to ask you, between you and Mickey, who's the better kazoo player?
Well, I had the better kazoo. He didn't get good luck, and I did. Because not all kazoos are made equally, you see.
So you were
playing. And I had one that played much better, so I could be heard a little better.
So you played lead kazoo.
I did.
I always got stuck with the crappy one anyway. I could never do those things.
I thought there was some technique I was supposed to know, and then my girlfriend handed me hers. I went, oh, this one works.
Was it fun?
Yeah, it was great fun. So and to honor Garcia is always a special moment for me. So.
Yeah, it's around this time of year that everybody thinks about Mr. Garcia and his music and his contributions and all.
Yeah, I like to call it the days between. He was born August 1 and left us on August 9th. So those are the days between.
But meanwhile, you're out touring with two different bands at the moment.
I am. I'm busy as I've ever been in my life. I didn't know I was going to get to do this much playing at this period of my life, but it's really going good, so I like it. They're two completely different bands. Rhythm Devils is so much different than Seven Walkers. It's really a joy to bounce them back and forth, you know, have the contrast.
Well, you've got Papa Molly and Matt Hubbard and either Reed Mathis or George Porter with the Seven Walkers.
Yeah, let me correct you there. It's George Porter full time now.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, that's awe from me, too. I mean, that's like a dream come true getting to play with that gentleman.
He's one funky individual, isn't he?
Yeah, he knows what he's doing.
As it should be. I mean, he's got a drummer that knows what he's doing and a guitar player.
Well, yeah, I love it. I love it that we're playing together because it's like psychedelia meets New Orleans. So we call it Swampadelic.
It's a whole new form of music.
Yeah, why not?
And you're also out there touring with Mickey and the Rhythm Devils.
Yeah, That's going good.
And I just got to tell people that in the area coming up, you've got 3 nights of Rhythm Devils music coming up. You want me to read down the places and dates and stuff like that?
Yeah, if you want, you can put them on the air. That'd be great.
Okay. At the Tarrytown.
Let me interrupt you for a second. You can also go to my website, BillKreutzmann.com, and all the dates are listed there. They're also listed on my Facebook page, too.
Just so that the listening audience knows, in Westchester County, up at the Tarrytown Music Hall, on August 28th, the Rhythm Devils will be playing. I don't know if you've ever been to the Tarrytown Music Hall before.
I knew you were going to ask me these hard questions. I don't remember all the gigs. I'm afraid many that kind of run together, my friend.
I'll tell you what. The Tarrytown Music Hall was designed by the same people who built Carnegie Hall before they built Carnegie Hall.
Ah, their practice hall, you might say.
Yes, and it's a beautiful, tiny little hall. I don't think it seats more than 1,200 people.
Oh, cool.
And it's all wood and bas relief cutouts and ornate plaster work and wooden floors and stuff, and it's a really nice place to play.
Is it as acoustically perfect as Carnegie Hall is?
It sounds really nice inside. I think you guys will have a good time with the sound there.
Yeah, I like those places because you don't have to play hard. They're not big outdoor gigs, and you actually play real light, and it sounds big. You know, you let the the PA do all the work. You don't have to, you know, kill it so much. It's fun.
Well, I was there one night with when David Bromberg was playing, and he and his band actually walked down off the stage right into the front of the hall, right in front of the audience, and played, and it was audible with no sound reinforcement, no microphones whatsoever.
Perfect. Wow. Yeah. And this is with Rhythm Devils. We might be a little overkill in there, but we'll be careful.
I'm sure you'll be fine. Also, the night after that, you're playing at the Blue Point Brewing Company on August 29th, and then on September the 1st at B.B. King's here in New York City.
Yeah, I can't wait for those gigs. You know, let's get going right now.
All right. Put you on a plane. Send them on out here.
Yeah, pretty soon.
So would you mind if we try to resuscitate some memories from the past?
You can try. I'll give it my best shot.
Okay. We dug up the name of a band from 1963 that you were in called the Zodiacs.
Yeah, that's a good dig. You must have a very sharp shovel.
I do, and I pride myself on digging deep. So
good. Yeah, I'll tell you about that band. This will blow your mind. Troy Weidenheimer was a lead guitar player. He was like the notable guitar player in Palo Alto in that moment. And Garcia played bass. And that was actually the first time I ever played music with Jerry. Pigpen was doing his Pigpen thing, and there might have been one other guitar player. It might have been Bob Hunter.
Really?
Yeah, because they would play together in a jug band, and this was just a sidelight to that.
So this was an electric band that was the adjunct to Jerry's acoustic stuff.
Yeah, there was, you know, that was sort of what was going on back in those days. Wasn't that around the time Dylan was at the folk festival?
Yep.
And he played electric, and the audience kind of freaked out at him.
Yes, yes, so it certainly
everybody
did.
Was doing that. All the folk guys, and that was Garcia and his group of folks. You know, they were all going, wanted to go electric.
So did you have a gig at the time over at Morgan's Music?
I did. That was after that, actually.
Because I understand that you...
I was like 16 or 17 years old when I played the Troy gig, or the Zodiac.
Uh-huh. Did you sell a banjo to Garcia at one point?
I did. I did all that. That's true. Well, that was the very first time I met him. That was even before I played with the Zodiacs, I think. My dad was trying to learn banjo, and he didn't. Yeah, my dad didn't get into it, so he put it for sale and piled off the newspaper and sold it to Jerry for $15. There was this knock at the door, and there was Jerry, and I'd never seen him before, you know. So, hey, nice to meet you. And then, lo and behold, we become players together for a long time.
Yeah, a bit of time. I guess, you know, you just keep bumping into people. It was probably a pretty small community back then.
I know. Yeah, it's true. It's like that.
Did your sixth grade teacher tell you that you couldn't keep a beat and that you were...
Well, yeah. She, it wasn't her fault. I mean, she had a class of 20, you know, 20 or 25 kids, and she was probably right at the time. And she never taught me to read music the second day of class, you know, once a week at music class. Because I wanted to play music no matter what, no matter what kind, but that changed, too, after that class. She just said, you know, you can't keep a beat, and I said, well, you never taught me how to read music. How do you expect me to? I didn't know anything about it. It was March music, so it wasn't my thing. I was listening to R&B by then, all kinds of different music, funky music.
Did you cross paths with Aldous Huxley after that?
Yeah, I did. That's a real story, too, and I'd gotten about, when I was now, I was up to about 16, and I went away to private school in Arizona called a school called ORME. O-R-M-E, and I couldn't keep my grade point average. This is embarrassing, sort of, but not really. It's, all this stuff ends up to be fortuitous, you know. You know the theory about everything that happens to you in your life, probably supposed to happen to you.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so because I couldn't keep on the football team, I was a redshirted freshman and was kicking ass on the football team, and we won every game that year. And so my dad, God bless him, he sent my drums out to the school in Arizona from Palo Alto. I grew up in Palo Alto. He crated all my drums. I didn't have any drum cases, of course. He crated them all up and sent them out, and I was allowed to play drums after school, and that really saved me. And one day I was playing, and the headmaster and this guy who had Coke bottles for glasses walks in. It was Aldous Huxley, who I'd never even heard of at that age, right? And the headmaster gives me the finger to the mouth sign for shut up or be quiet, whatever. And the other guy with the glasses gave him an elbow in the ribs and said, no, let him play. I've never heard anything like that. And so he had me complete. Now the headmaster's telling me, okay, keep playing, you know, because he'll do anything for Huxley, of course. And later on that night, we heard an outrageous lecture by him. It was way over my head, but I went and researched it later. I got my publicist to go look for it, and he found it. And it was actually about manipulating human beings. He was English, Huxley, and he was very afraid that because of where we were going with genetics and things, that we were going to start making perfect people. And he was really dead. No.
Well, clearly that hasn't happened.
Well,
no. Very good point. Good point, brother. That's funny.
So you were taking drum lessons like continuously, and I understand you ended up on Perry Lane at the Chateau a couple of years later.
I did. The Chateau wasn't quite on Perry Lane, but a lot of people that would go to Perry Lane at that time, now it's all apartments or condos, rather. But back then it was little cottages, and my drum teacher had one, and Ken Kesey had one almost next door. And we'd rub shoulders, and once again, I was 16. I didn't know who he was. But coming to meet him later on in life, it was quite interesting.
No doubt. It had a great effect on not only you, but the entire society in which we live.
Yeah, right? Yeah. It was, I mean, he did a really courageous thing. He was there at the Veterans Administration Hospital in Palo Alto, and he had volunteered for LSD experiments because that was probably at the time the only place he knew he could get LSD. And one day the doctor said, "Well, what are you feeling?" He said, "Nothing. It didn't work. Nothing happened this time." Lying through his teeth, and walked out into the world and go, this is where you're supposed to take this stuff. Not in a white room with guys in white coats.
Standing over you with clipboards, right?
Yeah, and clipboards. And how do you feel now? Big dark glasses. You know.
But the Chateau, I understand, was like quite the hang. It was the place.
It was. I actually went up there and played a couple of times. Everybody wanted to play, so you know, I had to wait in line because I was a kid drummer. But I got to play finally. It was really fun.
Did you run into Garcia and Weir and those and Lesh?
Garcia and so actually no, I went there with somebody else. I don't remember now. I wasn't. They were probably around because everybody was around. But once again, I was just this naive 16-year-old. I just knew that the people I was going to school with, bless their hearts, weren't the people I was going to hang with in later life. I always wanted to be with like the Beats or somebody that had some more craziness going for them.
So what was it like for you guys being in the Warlocks, a struggling young band in you know, Northern California?
Well, it was a struggle. I whether this is good or not, I was the first manager of that band, or the only manager of the Warlocks. And we worked for Graham. I remember we had earned maybe $500 one night, you know, which was a fortune in those days. And everybody was like, yeah, great. And then we go through a drought with no gigs at all. And then what became the most regular gig was doing the acid test, because we could always go there and play.
Well, tell us about the acid test, because Garcia said that the freedom of not being able to play at the acid test was the most liberating thing that he ever encountered.
Yeah, it's not being able to play. What he means is not being able to play in a way that you might consider good music, you know, because when you're that high, you're listening to 20 different bands all at the same time, and, you know, it's different for everybody, but I know what he means. To me, it was just like, "Oh, this is far out." Once I remember one of them was going to pack up my drum set, and it seemed like it took forever.
Things slowed down.
Everything went really. Oh,
time space continuum.
This nut goes here, and turn this wing nut there, and that kind of stuff.
And it really didn't matter what you played specifically, right?
No, it didn't matter at all. And then why? The Warlocks are playing at one end of this thing. Kesey and his guys and Ken Babbs and all the other pranksters, they set up at the other end of it. We kind of had a standoff. They'd play as loud as they could as we played. And they had a thing called the Thunder Machine, which they would just pound into oblivion. It was this giant, like, 8-foot-tall metal sculpture with all these big metal panels and just, you know, take baseball bats and stuff. And that was their drums in space, and then we were doing ours out the other end. Kind of interesting.
Yeah, Kesey actually brought the Thunder Machine to the East Coast about 20 years ago. I saw him at a concert that he did, and he brought a couple of the pranksters out, and they went at it for about 5 or 10 minutes out there on stage.
I know that. Well, that 5 or 10 minutes is more like 5 hours at the acid test. So anyway, they were outrageous times. You know, it's hard to talk about in this short interview.
Yeah, well. It was sort of like you had a little secret at that point. Wasn't it still a pretty closed-in community, you know, in terms of people who knew about it and knew what was going on?
I think so. They advertised and they put out posters and things like that, but, I mean, it wasn't on the radio or anything. But people, you know, they did know.
What was it like after the Grateful Dead got rolling and you began to expand the horizons a little bit? What was it like touring in like 66, 67, 70, you know?
It was totally exciting. I mean, it's something we always wanted to do, and we knew we weren't going to just be playing in one town in San Francisco. We knew we wanted to move around. So touring was fun, and it was fun to play music everywhere, and it was also fun to go to places you've never been.
What was it like?
The Midwest was an experience for me. It was like, God, this exists somewhere? You know? Because when you come from the coast, it's different. You get lots of stuff all at once, you know, especially in New York, right?
You
grow up fast. I always figure when I used to watch, I don't know, American Bandstand or one of those shows when I was growing up as a teenager, I go, God, those people seem so much older than me, you know?
But they weren't. It was just different, right?
No, that's just different. I just didn't know. So anyway, that's what traveling really was fun about, was you got to meet other people and see how other people live and what their life's like in, around this country.
And eventually the audiences grew and you know.
Yeah.
So
they grew really big, and by mid-80s we were the top in Polestar, and we did really good for a couple of years in there.
Oh, yeah. You guys were the preeminent touring band, you know, number one on the charts.
For a little while we were. And that was pretty far out, you know. That wasn't my favorite time, believe it or not. I mean, I love that we could attract that many people, but it lost the element of intimacy. And I really like, that's why I like these smaller gigs that I'm doing now, especially with Seven Walkers and Rhythm Devils, but I'm getting to be closer to the audience. And that's really cool. We just played two nights, I think I told you, at the Great American Music Hall just this last Saturday and Friday nights. And the audience is like 10 feet from me.
Ah,
audiences appreciate that too. You know, the intimacy of a smaller place.
Yeah, and I had people smiling at me all night right in the front. That's just, that. You mean, that's a great workplace, you know. It's not work anymore when it's like that. But when you play a giant stadium, people are so damn far away from you. You're just hoping it's going out good, you know. You're doing what you think sounds good, so it will, but you get what I mean.
Yeah, this is immediate feedback.
Yeah.
So we understand that when you met Mickey Hart, you had met him at a concert that he went to see for the Count Basie Orchestra,
and it was a Count Basie. Yeah, it was a Bill Graham Presents with the Fillmore West, and it was Count Basie, and Sonny Payne was the drummer, and we both sat there in amazement watching this cat play drums. No microphones on the band at all, but you could hear that bass drum all over that hall. You didn't need a microphone on it. Made you jump when he hit it. They did this thing. They played real quietly their first song, just like half the volume I'm talking at now, and then all of a sudden Payne would just stand on his bass drum, and the thing was like a cannon shot. The whole room, you can see it, wakes everybody up instantly, and now you're in the swing of it, you know. So, Basie used to say, this is always a really great lesson for people that want to learn dynamics, is if you can't hear the acoustic guitar, you're playing too loud, stuff like that.
He had Freddie Green on acoustic at that time, didn't he?
Maybe. I'm not sure the personnel. I just remember Payne being a drummer. I kind of fixated on that, I guess.
Yeah, and then I guess Mickey got drawn into the Grateful Dead orbit.
Well, yeah, I asked him because he showed me what he was, you know, because he was a rudimentary champion a year or two before that, where I met him. And I said, God, I don't know all those things. And he just sat me down and started showing me all the stuff, which really helped my drumming. There's a reason why drummers learn rudiments, you know.
So it was sort of, you know, I was listening recently to a concert from, I think, 69 or late 69, mm-hmm. early 70, and it sounded like you guys were using military snares.
I don't remember those, but I believe you. I have another snare I use now that I travel. It travels with me. It's like a guitar. I don't remember the military snares, but you mean deep snares, like marching snares?
Yeah, like a marching snare, because it really cut through the mix.
Uh-huh. Well, that could be the good sound guy, too, I hope.
Yeah, well,
but, I don't remember that too much.
So you guys eventually got up on stage, and I hear you played Alligator for like 35 minutes or something?
Yeah. The very first gig, it was Mickey. I was at the Straight Theater. Yeah, we had a lot of fun right from the get-go. So it just worked out. And the rest is history, you know. So history has better memory than I do.
So eventually you guys got to the point where, at the start you both had trap kits up on stage. But then it began to, you know, to broaden out a little bit, and he did more percussion stuff. And
well, we just started, instead of, you know, a lot of times that you see two drummers play, and Mickey and I used to do this, and we would just mimic each other and play the same thing, basically, as much as that's possible. And we thought, God, that's not a good use of this. Why don't we open it up, like you just said? And I got Mickey to use more tom-toms. I actually put another tom up, and we had some of the first drum sets that ever had three rack toms across the top way back when. And that's just has kept evolving to today in Rhythm Devils. He's got a lot of electronic sounds up there, which are just cool as hell in the beam. And he has these other really great sounds. They're all recorded sounds, but they really work good. They're not just common, type of electronic sounds. They're much farther out, I would say. I like them a lot. I mean, right now, today, it's working the best. We just use one bass drum. You don't need two bass drums.
Mm-hmm.
Usually on a bass drum, less is more. So,
was there like a big readjustment when he left the band in 71?
There was for me. It was like, because I'm so used to having all that sound over there, I had to start filling it up more, so it took a couple of gigs for me to get it back. But it came back, and I had really good shows there in the early 70s.
Yeah. The other one song began to take on a life of its own, completely different from the 68, 69, 70s other ones.
Right. It's just different with one drummer than two, but one drummer can't do what two can do, but... You know, there's just different things. I never get into the thing of better or worse. It's just different. It's apples and oranges, yeah. And I like them both. You know, I don't think one is better than the other by any means.
Did Mickey actually hypnotize you at one point?
Well, he tried to, and I pretended to be hypnotized.
Well, let's just break for a half a second here. We're having the pleasure of talking with Bill Kreutzmann. Drummer extraordinaire with the Grateful Dead and Seven Walkers and the Rhythm Devils. Seven Walkers and Rhythm Devils are both out there on the road these days. My name's Don Grossinger. We have Stu Robbins on the other side of the other microphone, and Bill's out there in Hawaii living the life.
Yeah, I am.
We're here in New York.
You're living a life there. It's just different kinds, you know.
That's true. The thing is,
this time I only get 7 days at home. I'm working so much. I'm back out on Wednesday. But in your way.
Well, we'll be welcoming you with open arms, I'm sure, open ears.
Good.
You guys listened an awful lot. That's something that was absolutely necessary to the kind of music you were playing.
You have to have really big ears, because without that, it can't change. I make sure when I do monitors to this very day, of course, I make sure I got everything I need in the monitors, not just me, not just the vocals or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to have a really good full band sound.
Before we leave the 60s, can I... pop in and pick your brain a little bit for...
Yeah, sure, if I can remember once again.
Well, the 60s, in my mind's eye, was a unique era for young people in particular.
Uh-huh.
Not only was it the first time in our history that the youth movement in America had a serious voice in shaping modern society, but the quote-unquote revolution also affected the music industry greatly. You were performing right smack in the middle of that. What sort of things you recollect from that era that you stick out in your head that maybe you kept with you that maybe have arisen from that time, if you will?
Yeah, good, really good question. That's a long one, actually, a long answer, but I'm giving it my best shot. The first thing I remember is, and I feel about that now as an observation, is right for some reason that period of time had more effect on society than any other time since then. With ending the Vietnam War, complaining about the Vietnam War wasn't quite ending then. But and it just, I know some people, it just got tons of media attention, and it had more effect than big demonstrations today, too. I mean, I know Kent State was a horrible thing, and that had a big effect on people, but let's look at where we're at right now. We're fighting two wars in this world, and I don't think we've come very far. I think the doors that were opened in the 60s are still wide open and need to be traveled through. I don't think they've been traveled through yet.
It was a very tumultuous time, indeed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's
but sure. it was a tumultuous time in a way that was like birthing.
Maybe we need more tumultuous these days.
I would, you know, and I put it even to Henry Thoreau. He's my hero, okay, one of them. And he says nonviolent demonstrations and all this, but he means in a much, not just going out and yelling or not even yelling, but just, he says, like, if we all stop paying taxes for a year.
That'll teach him.
You know, the people in America are so naive. I just heard this by George Carlin, and I agree with him totally, that we're all bought, and we don't know it. But you guys know it. The people in the press know it. But some people don't know that their vote doesn't really count. They think it counts. But what ends up happening is the lobbyists come in there from the big corporations, from Monsanto, you name it, BP now is on the terrible list. And Price Shell, too, and all these big corporations. They're the ones that really run this country.
Oh, absolutely.
And I want to get back to this point. Garcia was always apolitical, and he held such an apolitical stance that, say, if he hadn't died in 95 and Obama was running for president, he wouldn't have backed him. Because he knows that politicians, no matter how good their hearts are and how good their intentions are, if there are those kind of politicians.
Mm-hmm.
If they do have these great intentions, by the time they get all the way into politics in Washington, D.C., they are not allowed to hold those anymore. Because I'm hearing talk of nuclear power now, which is like not a good thing for me. So
yeah, and clean coal, you know. Where's that at? There is no clean coal.
It's like mutually exclusive terms.
Well, there's no clean coal either.
Yes.
I mean, he's appeasing those big corporations and stuff. And that's really sad for me to see that going. That's why I meant that these doors are really wide open now.
Well,
there hasn't been a great change.
I'll tell you, you're on a radio station that does not kowtow to the big corporations, WBAI
Excellent.
In New York. I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with Pacifica. Could you talk a little bit about the role of media and Pacifica?
Well, particularly the non-corporate radio station, I call them. My girlfriend works for one here on Kauai, and it's KKCR. And it has very varied programming. It's wonderful. It supports the people of this island and everywhere. And it's just like, to me, it's an honest radio station like your guys, you know. You don't have top 40, you're not playing pop music. Don't you have your own kinds of shows and stuff?
We have complete freedom as to what we play.
Wow. Very eclectic, yes.
It's unbelievable in this day and age.
It is unbelievable. You're a rarity. Even this KKCR, they got a new manager a while ago. And the FCC sent us a letter. They must have sent you a letter, too. And it says that you have to write down everything you did for an hour.
Yeah,
and
you got that letter also.
Yeah, we got that same damn letter. You can only play artists two or three times in that hour.
We freaked out.
I
ended up completely changing the show for about a month. And then we got the word that we didn't have to do that every show and all the time. So we're back to normal here.
Oh, good. Well, I didn't get that other letter.
No, I don't think there was another letter. That was just coming down the grapevine, and hopefully I'm still okay. And I'm for sure next week. You never know.
Yeah. But I mean, anyway, those kind of restrictions are just
It's baloney. It is.
It is baloney. This is the thing. It's like all the government agencies, and that's the FCC included, but, you know, environmental people, the EPA and all that kind of thing. There's a bunch of those groups in this country, and I don't want to go through and name them all. And there are all these supposed watchdog groups, but they're all governmental groups that are supposed to be watching the government. Well, there's something wrong with that. You know, it's like it's not really independent. It's not really outside. It's here it is, a government group watching its own stuff.
It's like a conflict of interest.
I would say that would be the best word, yeah. So I just have troubles with that, those kind of things, you know.
Well, we're trying to raise some money to keep this radio station on the air right now, and hopefully people will call in. I think, would it be okay with you if I gave the phone number 212-209-2950 to call our volunteers that are sitting back there?
And, yeah, do that.
You know, we're giving Crimson White and Indigo, the Grateful Dead new 3-CD set with the DVD in there as a premium if you contribute to the radio station.
Okay, cool. Oh, I can get that together.
Yeah, so
I'll do that when we're off the air. I don't want to bother the audience out there with this. Listen, how are we doing? My time is running kind of short here, my good friends.
Okay, we got
three. You got any home run ones you want to pass on?
Well, I have one question I want to ask you.
Go ahead, Stu.
If I were to take your iPod away from you, what would I find on there if you had
you
one?
You would completely love it. Good. Well, I made the old mistake, I don't do anymore, of putting my live music on there with no track numbers, distinctions on it. And so they go in there as numbers. So if you went through all the ones through tens, you'd have your mind blown. It's all my live stuff I've done the last couple of years. Then I have Marley, Coltrane. God, Stu, the list is ridiculous. I don't have it sitting in front of me. I could read it off to you, but It saves me on airplane flights. I listen to that thing. I go to sleep because music just takes me away from what's really going on in the world.
I'm sure.
You know. Can I ask you a quick question about David Crosby, If I Could Only Remember My Name sessions?
Yeah, that's a good question. It relates to this right now, too, because we're doing that song.
Oh. Tell us more. Did you enjoy those? I mean, that music was so
good. Oh, yeah, beautiful. No, those were good sessions, and the producer in that session was really easy to work with. He got a clean drum sound. It was simple.
Was that Stephen Barnhart?
And then to play that song. Yeah, play that song now is really fun. Davy Knoll sings it, and he does a great job with it, so it's cool. It's kind of come full circle in its own way, you know?
Could you tell us?
He knew that song. We went, you know that song? Let's try it. And it sounded so good, we kept it in the repertoire.
That's great. Could you tell us some stories about Pigpen and maybe one about Neil Cassidy?
Well, Neil Cassidy used to come into rehearsals, and he'd always come up to my and shake my hand and make sure I was loose because, you know, he was a pretty amped-up kind of guy, right? And so that was one thing I remember. Him and I always got along really well. Neil and I were good friends. And Pigpen and I were good friends, too. Pigpen was a real soulful brother. He was always playing his guitar, maybe drinking a little whiskey and singing to his girls, you know. And that was Pigpen. You know, he sang, played his acoustic guitar and you know, sang sweet nothings, I guess you could say. Anyway, there's a lot of memories, you guys. I'm going to say some of this from my book, okay?
I'm glad to hear you coming out with a book.
Congratulations, you guys. I hope you make lots of money.
Bill, thank you so much.
Yes, thank you very much, and it's been a privilege talking to you.
Absolutely.
We'll touch base hopefully next time you guys come around.
Yeah, I'd like to run into you guys. Thanks, Stu.
You take care.
All right, man.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.